religion and the civil rights movement long have known the Gandhian influence of our Martin Luther King Jr. and how he envisions the philosophy and tactics of nonviolence. But they have also acknowledged the encounters between Gandhi and black religious intellectuals of the 1930s and 1940s. Only a few among these thinkers have been examined in depth. Hence, it remains unclear how much the Indian leader affected their perspectives about the theology and methodology of social change. Sudarshan Kapoor showed that black leaders of the 1920s watched Gandhi's efforts to rid India of British colonizers and believed his nonviolent methods were applicable to the African-American freedom struggle. Walter E. Fluker illustrates in the forthcoming Howard Thurman papers and in other works Gandhi's impact upon Thurman's thought. While teaching and preaching at Howard University, Thurman interpreted Jesus as identifying with the disinherited and as sympathetic to the peaceful but confrontational tactics to achieve black advancement. Randall Jelch's writing about Benjamin E. Mays and his efforts to train an insurgent Negro clergy whose re-energized theology included Gandhian methods to defeat American apartheid. Thurman, Mays, and other black clergy academics, according to Kapoor, met Gandhi in India in the 1930s and 1940s and fertilized their thinking about harnessing Gandhian protest methods to prophetic black Christianity. Thurman, Mays, and their church and campus peers comprise a small but significant cadre of black male and female intellectuals who were thinking through the relationship between religion and its praxis for social change. The theological contributions of Mordecai W. Johnson to the strategies for black liberation, for example, badly needs exploration. As a mentor to Thurman and Mays, who encouraged them to meet Gandhi, and his influence upon Martin Luther King Jr. demonstrated his large role in introducing Gandhi to the nascent civil rights movement. Because the spouses of Thurman, Mays, and other black religious intellectuals traveled with them and developed their own views on the Indian leader, studies on Sue Bailey Durkin, for example, will be as significant as scholarship on their better-known spouses. William Stuart Nelson and Blanche Louise Wright Nelson became another crucial couple whose presence in India brought fresh religious perspectives to the black freedom struggle. They learned much about the role of nonviolence in shaping India and how Christianity, as compared to other world religions, provided theological and spiritual resources to fighters for black advancement in the United States. The American Friends Service Committee sponsored the Nelsons, both Congregationalists, in 1946 and 1947 for work and travel in India. As a result, they encountered Quaker pacifism and Gandhian nonviolence as intellectual sources for their Protestant liberationist ideas. These explorations, incubated in India, informed their teaching and lecturing on Gandhian methods and their reflections on nonviolent thinking and tactics in the years following their return from the Asian subcontinent. The presence of the Nelsons at Howard University exposed a new generation of students to nonviolence as an important area for academic inquiry. Their talks on Gandhi familiarized their audiences with the Indian leader and his ongoing relevance to the evolving civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Though the news about Africa's recently decolonized nations of Ghana and Nigeria inspired African Americans in 1957 and 1960, the theology and tactics of nonviolence which Gandhi pioneered in India provided tangible ways to energize their emancipatory efforts in the United States. The Nelsons played a large role in the dissemination of Gandhi's liberationist ethos. The American Friends Service Committee, established in 1917, provided non-combatant roles for Quakers who opposed violence in World War I. In subsequent decades, the AFSC launched global projects in crisis areas to aid refugees, orphans, and the starving. The group spread to India in 1947 to assist persons harmed by rioting and displacement during the country's partition. Following the lead of some American foundations, the AFSC became interested in integrating college and university faculty. Hence, in 1946, the agency sponsored Ira A. Augustine Reed as the first black professor at the Quaker affiliated Haverford College in Pennsylvania. Perhaps this president influenced the AFSC to recruit African Americans to serve in its foreign installations. There was one possibility in 1946 of a Negro girl who wanted to go to India, but her unavailability convinced the agency to continue inquiries for the right people, inquiringly qualified, irrespective of their race. Officials believe that appointing a Negro or a Negro couple is one that interests us a great deal. When William Stuart Nelson proposed that he and his wife spend his sabbatical from the School of Religion at Howard University in affiliation with the AFSC's Foreign Service Unit, some officials viewed it as an opportunity to bolster the agency by this additional interracial aspect. An invitation to the Nelsons to lecture at Calcutta University and to work at the Quaker-run Delhi Center seemed a sensible use of their talents. One official observed that Nelsons are such outstanding people that we should not leave any stone unturned in involving them in some phase of the American Friends Service Committee program. Within elite African-American academic and religious circles, the name William Stuart Nelson carried cachet. Born in Paris, Kentucky in 1895, he earned a BA at Howard University and in 1920 attended Union Theological Seminary in New York City and earned a Bachelor of Divinity from Yale Divinity School in 1924. Also, he studied in France at the Sorbonne and at the Protestant Theological Seminary in Paris and in Germany at the Universities of Berlin and Marburg. He taught religion at Howard University before becoming president of Shaw University and president of Dillard University during the 1930s. He returned to Howard in 1940 as dean of the Divinity School and remained there in various administrative positions and as a religion professor through his retirement in the 1960s. Blanche Nelson, a member of the female talented 10, fully participated in her husband's privileged position in higher education and pursued her own social service career. They impressed American Friends Service Committee officials with their pedigree and commitment to serve in India. They are not typical Negroes as far as facial appearances go, remarked one Friends official. They are high caliber and outstanding people. As word of the Nelsons navigated through the AFSC bureaucracy, however, some doubts were raised about the couple. Despite the desirability of having an integrated staff in the Indian mission, how would they function in the Delhi Center remained unresolved. One official, for example, said the absence of an expert on Indian affairs was a priority to be addressed before the Nelsons arrived. Moreover, the Nelsons desperately needed training at Pendle Hill, the Quaker Retreat Center in Pennsylvania, before going to India. Officials in one AFSC section refused to approve the Nelsons because of budgetary constraints and pressing personnel needs. Two specialists, for example, were required for rehabilitation work, a field in which the Nelsons had no expertise. The Nelsons, some staff believed, would be acceptable if their financing came from headquarters and not from their budgets in the field. These dubious sentiments about the Nelsons, despite the traditional racial liberalism of the Quakers, ran deep within the AFSC bureaucracy. It was stated that we are all keenly interested in having Negroes in the unit, said one memo. In fact, if given a choice between a black couple and a white couple, both having the same qualifications needed here, we would unhesitatingly choose a Negro couple. There were existing vacancies for specialists in agriculture, handicrafts, and cooperatives that neither William nor Blanche Nelson could fill. Both could be useful in famine relief, but there was adequate personnel in this area already, and besides, the Nelsons did not stay the required 2 to 3 years on a project. Conceding that the Nelsons were such exceptional people, the unit believed that approving this couple on the basis of their color would be indefensible and patronizing. These expressions from the field did not decide the fate of the Nelsons. Officials at AFSC headquarters in Philadelphia had initiated the general search for African-American volunteers and staff and decided that bureaucratic opposition would not thwart this effort. Some within the bureaucracy said they would welcome the idea of Negro appointees if there were other resources to carry out the objective. Headquarters officials, however, had no such doubts and declared the Nelsons approved for service in India. One Navy officer looked expectantly to the work the Nelsons would do for interracial understanding. These comments reflected the internal debate between headquarters officials and field officers about lofty but competing goals between promoting African American advancement and providing relief to a newly decolonized country. AFSC leaders were committed to pushing their organization to the forefront of the Black struggle for freedom. Involving the Nelsons was one way to achieve this objective, and at the same time internationalize the discourse about the oppressed conditions of the world's colored peoples. On the other hand, field personnel in India, while desirous of having the Nelsons in their unit, placed program priorities above the commendable but seemingly impractical objective that headquarters imposed upon them. Ed Peacock, a member of the headquarters staff in Philadelphia, understood the dilemma. Though the Nelsons knew about the doubts raised about them, Peacock told others that they had shared with the couple that the assessments in the field were only recommendations and not a final decision. Whether they would be placed at the French Deli Center or used in some capacity at this facility was the key question for Peacock. Assignments to India to a possible additional centers project was one way to resolve this bureaucratic conflict. In the end, an executive committee at the headquarters recommended the appointment of the Nelsons to India with funds coming from special centers committee budgets and not from any monies already appropriated in India field operations. Once the decision had been made, AFSC bureaucrats fell into line to support the Nelsons as fellow friends workers. "We are very happy to know that they are coming," said one field official. As the reticence toward the full embrace of the Nelsons there was immediate, considerations of several service possibilities for the couple surfaced. "We have approached the Vice Chancellor of the University of Calcutta with a view to arranging lectures for Nelson," observed one officer. "Involvement in a proposed work project in the bustings or slums of Calcutta was another idea. Since there were existing plans for a coordinating organization similar to the Council of Social Agencies of America, perhaps the Nelsons could help with this initiative. Though Indian cooperation and eventual Indian leadership was envisaged, the expertise of the Nelsons could aid in launching this needed venture." One staff person, previously doubtful about the couple, pushed the idea of them teaching at the University of Calcutta. The Vice Chancellor had been first to suggest that Nelson come to his institution to deliver a series of lectures. No doubt curiosity about America's racial issues had stirred his interest in this prominent African-American educator. It now seemed up to Nelson to decide about this type of service and what subject he feels best equipped to speak on to find one French official. A London officer agreed that Nelson's academic credentials should be used as extensively as possible, hoping he would lecture occasionally in England during a layover en route to India. Though willing to teach and lecture, Nelson had larger objectives in mind. He was deeply interested in the spirit and method of the Friends and the World Service. Moreover, Nelson, according to one officer, had a great desire to participate in our program and a broader acquaintance with other people and serving them in some way. Nelson stressed these things because he was trying to convince the Quakers to accept him as a volunteer in their Indian mission. This was, in part, a cover story. His president at Howard, Mordecai Johnson, already had spoken about Gandhi and his kinship to African-American activists. Nelson's predecessor as Dean of the School of Religion, Benjamin E. Mays, and his faculty colleague, Howard Thurman, had visited India to meet the Apostle of Soul Force. Nelson, however, wanted his own encounter with Gandhi and to learn his methodology and practices for social insurgency. Although some within the AFSC wanted Nelson confined to a university setting, others viewed him in some role in the Friends Service Union. An India Center executive heard that the Nelsons received appointments as Center Committee people and would be assigned to Calcutta. Disappointed that they could spend only a year instead of the standard 2 years, the Friends official, despite Nelson's academic accomplishments and his wife's impressive track record in community projects, believed they required further scrutiny. "Nelson," he said, she said, "is to give a lecture in Washington, and another official plans to hear him in order to have first-hand information about about his ability to be presented in India as a lecturer. She added, it is felt from what we know about him, his chief ability will lie in reaching into the universities and other educational institutions. When Nelson was appointed to head the Friends Service Unit in India, the news of this high-level position must have surprised him and his hidden detractors. Though unit members were credited with his selection, it is hard to believe that in light of their doubts, he would have been their choice. Headquarters staff in Philadelphia, the AFSC entity most interested in promoting interracialism, supported Nelson for this visible executive position and may have been his only advocates. That he was colored had nothing to do with it, had nothing to do with the appointments in Clarence E. Pickett, the executive secretary. There was stern work to do, and the man best fitted for the job was needed. William Stuart Nelson was that man, Pickett added. The Nelsons, before leaving the United States, proceeded to training preparation at Pendle Hill near Philadelphia. Then around September 3, 1946, they sailed for India. Although the AFSC had one objective in mind for the Nelsons, the couple aimed at different goals. The Friends, building on a long tradition of African-American advocacy, viewed the Nelsons as their latest experiment in interracialism. Despite some stiff resistance within the India unit, headquarters staff determined that examples of interracial understanding in the midst of deadly religious rivalries between Hindus and Muslims required the sponsorship of the Nelsons. This educated couple, though sympathetic to the racial altruism of the Friends, were searching for prophetic ideas and tactics to address racism and racial inequality in the United States. The Nelsons believed their sojourn in India would deepen their understanding of the pacifist ethos of the Friends and introduce them to the nonviolent ideology of the Hindu, Gandhi. These ideas would invigorate their espousal of the Christian social gospel and provide a praxis for a liberationist black religion which sought the elimination of America's racial caste system. Despite a Quaker presence in India since the 19th century and the establishment in 1943 of a Center for Adult Education, sustained AFSC involvement commenced toward the 1944-1945 Bengal famine. During this crisis, the organization fed innumerable children in canteens, and they helped in a number of relief efforts. One official told Nelson after his arrival in Calcutta that Friends centers in eight countries, including India, function as a religiously-based service, focusing areas of international tension, aimed at a common search for solutions which will increase international understanding. Friends centers were meant to be meeting places of a two-way interpretation and places where like-minded people can share in an attempt to restate changeless verities in response to contemporary circumstances. Additionally, the official informed Nelson that the religious experience undergirding the Friends Center was in no way sectarian and made no effort to make Quakers out of people. Rather, they highlighted the value of strength from silent meditation and provided insights to help in advancing peace and mutual understanding. A year before the Nelsons arrived in India, the AFSC settled in Bassahar region, where Friends Cooperative Project and Industrial Center an agricultural project already was operating. There were additional initiatives in feeding children in East Bengal, Bihar, and Calcutta, milk distribution in Madras, maternity, child welfare, and midwifery programs in cooperation with the Red Cross in India, and social services in the slums, and carrying on rehabilitation and reconciliation efforts in Rajasthan, Bihar, and East Bengal. William and Blanche Nelson landed in India sometime in October 1946. During their first 5 months, they traveled extensively, especially within the Bengal region, visiting Friends projects and speaking to countless audiences. Both Nelsons were visibly and seriously engaged in the object of curiosity of Indians unfamiliar with African Americans. They saw the Friends project at Rafapur, where Spanish and English classes were held. The Nelsons also visited villages in their houses of thatched roofs, dirt floors, and the barest minimum of articles for living, and learned to speak some Bengali. In Bassahar, they observed industrial and agricultural projects and said it was inspiring to see the pretty fabrics being woven by Indian hands and feet and to walk across the fields of our venture in cooperative farming. His first speech occurred at Sentakeethan, a Bengalese university community where prominent poet was born. He also lectured to the History and Political Science Association of Madras Christian College at an annual meeting of the YWCA and in other venues. Before the initial evaluations of Nelson had been completed, few friends had appreciated his impressive administrative credentials. Having been president of two colleges and dean of a seminary, Nelson would have no trouble running a friend's service union. The value-added element for him, however, lay in his exposure to friends' methodologies for addressing interreligious conflict and implementing their pacifist philosophy through social and religious services. Hence, his supervisory responsibilities in India benefited both the American Friends Service Committee and Nelson himself. Clearly reminiscent of his duties as an academic administrator, Nelson dealt with broad issues of staffing and budget by dealing with bursar issues and a whole host of personnel issues. His administrative responsibilities, though substantial, did not prevent him from fulfilling his sabbatical objectives in India. His ongoing travels drew him to additional audiences anxious to learn from him the state of race relations in the United States. He also studied Quakerism, its pacifism, and how this philosophy proposed solutions to interreligious and inter-ethnic conflicts. Ultimately, he met Mahatma Gandhi and was affirmed that nonviolence could invigorate movements for African American advancement. He concluded that the peace pursuits of the Quakers and the soul force espoused by the Gandhians provided Black Christianity with what previous generations of professors and pastors had not envisioned. Though protest methods pursued through boycotts and demonstrations were familiar tactics to them, none had been systematically conceptualized and anchored in serious theological and religious reflection. Nelson sustained exposure to French projects in India, his encounter with Gandhi, and his many conversations about American race relations deepened his commitment to finding religious resources to energize the Black struggle for freedom. Moreover, Blanche Nelson fully shared in her husband's intellectual inquiries about Quakerism and Gandhian ideas. In fact, her immersion in French programs equaled Nelson's involvement, and her exchange of views with Indian audiences was no less extensive than her spouse's interactions. Hence, any analysis of what the Nelsons learned and later imparted to African Americans must be viewed as their joint venture. A second tour of India, which the Nelsons undertook in March 1947, embraced these multiple interactions, involvements, and inquiries. In Lahore, for example, they arrived after episodes of interreligious violence between Hindus and Muslims. Though his public appearances were canceled because of curfews, Nelson delivered three lectures and a sermon and had discussions with various faculty and students. He was mindful that these presentations were done against a background of violent religious conflict. He recalled fire engines rushed through the streets, and there was every indication that a mob was bearing down upon our section. He knew the feeling of utter helplessness which one experiences when faced by a frenzied and hostile crowd, armed or partially armed. He lamented that this is the kind of suffering which goes on now in many parts of India. Moreover, it is far more widespread than actual attacks and is exactly a terrific mental toll. It was in Lahore that Nelson gained a deep appreciation and a renewed commitment to learning what Quaker projects could do to ameliorate or eliminate violence between warring religious groups anxious to end their powerlessness in this period following the end of British colonialism. With race relations in the United States never far from his mind, Nelson had to ponder how friends' involvements in India applied to the Black struggle for freedom. In Delhi, though he spoke about issues in American education for faculty at Delhi University, Nelson focused on race relations to other groups that the Quaker Center had arranged. The Quaker Center discussion group heard him expound on the race problem in America, YMCA listened to his thoughts about welfare in the colored community and the Christian attitude toward the colored problem. And the Asian Relations Conference of the Indian Council of World Affairs received his musings about the American Negro in law and in fact. His experiences in Bombay were similar to his visits into Lahore and Delhi. Again, he gave numerous speeches to Indian groups, and these talks ranged from race relations to the problems of international understanding. Like Lahore, there was urban unrest in Bombay, including the most crippling tramway strike, and yet none of Nelson's lectures were canceled, and that impressed him greatly. His interaction with followers of Parsi thought and practice led him to additional study of this sect with Zoroastrian religion. Later, he would commend this faith tradition for having a stronger commitment to love as Christianity, especially the mandate to be ready to serve to relieve the poor. These principles for Nelson underlay any espousal of nonviolence as a tactic in social change. Hence, these sentiments were reflected in Nelson's lectures on America's problematic race relations. He told Indian audiences that racial segregation and discrimination in the United States grew directly from the determination of a large section of American white people, principally but not exclusively of the southern states, to prevent the 13 million descendants of Negro slaves from ever attaining a position of equality. He added that this antagonism derived from the general tendency among men to transmit their own sentiments and those of their elders to the generations that follow. Fear of losing white dominance and ongoing efforts to deprive African Americans of education also fixed blacks in their subordinate status. Nelson commented on African American organizations that aggressively challenged and confronted racist systems in attempts to stop their oppressive policies. A. Philip Randolph's March on Washington movement, an opponent to employment discrimination, was built upon the principle of nonviolent cooperation communicated to it directly by a former white follower in India of Mahatma Gandhi. He observed that Negroes would find a potent instrument in this type of sacrificial spirit of non-cooperation, which has proved so successful in India. Nelson further declared that the American people do have a conscience and are sensitive to any dramatic expression of suffering. A continuous, widespread, and deeply serious campaign of non-cooperation of Negroes would affect the attitudes of whites substantially and perhaps critically. A mass hunger strike as a protest against brutalities, mass non-utilization of segregated public carriers, and non-attendance at segregated places of amusement are important possibilities. In these and in many other ways, the attention of America and the world would be called constantly and more strikingly at present to the Negro's plight. Nelson, however, seemed unduly pessimistic about the prospects of integrating nonviolent direct action tactics into the black struggle for freedom. I do not entertain great hope that such a program will be adopted, he said to his Indian audience. He continued and asserted that a leadership which believes deeply and is disciplined in a non-cooperative way is lacking. A considerable following is available, but one questions whether anyone or more persons will ever emerge to teach the masses and lead them in the use of this method of proved effectiveness. Of course, Nelson had not yet met Thurman student James Farmer of Poor, or Mays' progeny, Martin Luther King Jr., or the principal son of an AME Zion minister, James M. Lawson Jr. The Nelsons also thought seriously about how Quaker methods could end violent internecine conflicts and diffuse other hostilities between religious and ethnic groups. Hence, it was important for the couple and Indians themselves to understand Quakerism and its relevance to India's diverse populations. After two extended tours of friends' projects and to address various Indian organizations, Nelson was pleased to receive from friends' headquarters a guide to true peace. "We are finding it an excellent companion," Nelson said, "and we are interested to know how eagerly others are reading the copies which have been received." Nelson and other friends officials found that their Indian field staff showed increased interest in Quakerism. Notwithstanding the need to expound philosophical questions in Bengali, there seems some urgency to offer Quaker instruction as soon as practicable. Since these staff were expected to work on French projects and pursue activities which were consistent with Quaker principles, they surely required greater grounding in this faith tradition. Greetings from Nelson and other French officials to about 40 attendees at a Quaker conference opened in May 1947. The presentations covered history and French philosophy and Quaker worship, and the conference crowd reported enthusiasm among the participants about learning more about Quakerism. And they also initiated efforts to more visibly and more regularly initiate Quaker worship services at the Calcutta Center. The French conference reaffirmed Nelson's resolve to make the center services as authentically Quaker as possible. He and his Calcutta Worship Committee believed that the Philadelphia and London yearly meetings should offer their views on the quality of the order of service. They were particularly concerned about compliance with the document Friends Meeting for Worship, where it said, "It is true that our faith stems from the Christian tradition, and most of us therefore find our highest inspiration in the life of Christ. However, Friends believe that each person should be free to follow the highest truth he knows, and do not insist that each individual find that highest truth in Christ. Since some presentations at the Quakerism Conference appeared ambiguous on these issues, Nelson required a clarification from Friends' authorities. In correspondence with them, Nelson learned that essentially the Quakers were Christian and pacifist, though it includes members who may not call themselves Christian in any orthodox sense. As a result, membership, said one of the officials, is therefore offered as into a Christian society, but we do not ask for explicit statements as to what applicants understand by the term Christian. Moreover, attendance at fellowship and other meetings for worship are, of course, open and free to all, whatsoever their basis, and all are welcome. But fundamentally, pacifism was the foundational principle for Quakerism. For Nelson, this response was especially crucial because of the majority non-Christian staff on French projects who sought more understanding of Quakerism and the relation between its principles and the relief and peace efforts that they promoted in India. One of the officials elaborated on one of the conference presentations in which the Quaker stand on peace appeared a bit obscure. Instead of mildly stating the connection between the belief in the inner life and the peace testimony, it should be understood that the tie between the two is reciprocal, and that the pacifist Quaker would courageously strike a blow for peace. What Nelson wanted from the conference on Quakerism and from his worship services was a conscientiousness and intentionality about Friends' philosophy and practices and their applicability to social and political conditions in a newly independent India. What Blanche Nelson did in social services and conflict resolution demonstrated the linkage between the belief in the inner life and the peace testimony that Quakers espoused. She, even more than her spouse, tested these ideas in regular interaction with grassroots Indians in a number of different projects in the slums of Calcutta. Some involved Muslim girls and young women who spoke a variety of Indian languages, and she had a number of educational projects in which they were involved, and she tried to put Muslim, Sikh, Burmese, and Hindu young women together to learn something about interracial and interreligious and interethnic amelioration of their conflicts. Nelson carried on her work in an atmosphere of heightened religious and ethnic tensions in Calcutta. The end of British colonialism resulted in a partition which created an independent and Hindu-dominated India and a Muslim-ruled and non-contiguous East and West Pakistan. A massive migration of people from each religious group to the respective countries where their preferred majorities prevailed, and disputes between these groups over contested territories created substantial unrest within India. Therefore, Blanche Nelson thought it wise to center our attentions on the building of friendships and on those interests where there is agreement, rather than plunge immediately into discussions of a controversial nature. Even when Blanche Nelson traveled within India with her spouse, Nelson learned several lessons that she later articulated to her Quaker colleagues. The rigors of staying on the road for 9 months during one tour took the Nelsons as far south as Travancore, and as far north as Lahore, and as far west as Bombay, going by every form of conveyance in India except first class and air. The couple met peasants, professors, students, and government officials. Moreover, they lived in homes and bungalows and slept on floors and beds and even sat up all night once, more than once, on trains. Though they shared these inconveniences, Blanche Nelson carried away her own perspectives and reflections about India and its peoples. During this particular tour, she delivered 16 lectures to a variety of groups, some as small as 20, some as large as 700, on a variety of topics like why she had come to India, a message from an American woman to India, citizenship in the new India, and race relations in America. The pacifism and intergroup comedy that the Friends fostered in India still lacked a precise praxis which compelled change. The Nelsons, no matter how admiring they were of the Quakers, knew about Mahatma Gandhi and the nonviolent direct action strategies he deployed rid this country of British colonialism. Quakerism, like emancipatory black religion, was long on fervent belief in establishing social justice, but was short on effective methodologies to achieve their lofty objectives. The Nelsons already belonged to a small network of elite religious intellectuals, which included Benjamin and Sadie Mays, Howard and Sue Bailey Thurman, and the other educated couples who had met Gandhi. The Nelsons, like the Mazes and the Thurmans, believed black religion harnessed the Gandhian nonviolence to undermine American apartheid. Quaker officials asked Gandhi about how Friends projects could aid the development of an independent India. In conversation with one officer, Gandhi warned that in doing their work, the Quakers should serve without any ulterior motive. He added that nothing could do greater harm to Christianity or to the spirit of Christ than the wish to convert or to proselytize. Even as Friends units were engaged in relief efforts, they needed to be done in the right spirit, a spirit of utter humility. Gandhi especially criticized the Red Cross because it had been too closely linked to the British Crown, notwithstanding the group's commendable relief efforts among Indians. He also said that we should never, under any circumstance, associate ourselves with the way of violence. Friends official stressed to Gandhi that the Quakers emphasized in India their peace witness as a basis of our recruitment rather than our membership of the Society of Friends. Hence, there was no missionary agenda attached to any Quaker initiatives either in India or elsewhere. Gandhi was skeptical. The Nelsons in various venues within India echoed some of the same sentiments as Gandhi. Their belief in the indigenization of Friends projects responded to Gandhi's charge that Western relief workers should respect those they help. The methods that Europeans and Americans needed to adopt would value the multiple cultures within India, avoid attitudes of superiority, and abandon proselytizing. Blanche Nelson recalled that Gandhi shared with her husband a principle on how to blend relief and rehabilitation in Friends, urban, and village projects that preserved the dignity of Indian clients. Gandhi's recommendation focused on the spiritual importance of helping men meet their physical needs. He observed, to the hungry, God is food. To the naked, God is clothing. To the homeless, God is shelter. Nelson also sponsored a conference on village reconstruction, which included the Gandhian approach. Though the Nelsons drew from Gandhi specific suggestions about improvements in the Friends India Initiative, their preferred inquiries revolved around the empowerment of subject peoples. The Nelsons, despite endorsing Gandhi's criticism of Quakers and other Westerners for robbing Indians of their autonomy, wanted him to show how the segregation of African Americans resembled the condition of subordinate populations in the Asian subcontinent. That's why Nelson was anxious to discuss American race relations with the Indian leader. In response, Gandhi invited Nelson to travel with him to Noakhali in East Bengal. Nelson was exhilarated that he was present at prayer meetings on three different days and had spent a period of more than 20 24 hours in his ashram. In this setting, Nelson and Gandhi discussed the segregated circumstances of Black Americans. Nelson solicited Gandhi's opinion on whether the nonviolent, non-cooperation approach could address our Negro-white problem. Gandhi cautioned that while the Indian population had received his teaching of nonviolence, they imbibed only the methods of passive resistance and not nonviolence in thought, word, and deed. Hence, Gandhi declared he was perplexed and in darkness. He regretted being in darkness in South Africa in 1907 because in rebuttal to claims that nonviolent cooperation was for the weak, Gandhi said it was both for the strong and the weak. Since only 13,000 Indians lived in South Africa, Gandhi, in retrospect, thought his equivocation had been counterproductive. Nonetheless, he held to his principles, especially as Christian clergy criticized his citation of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. They claimed these teachings were meant for Jesus' disciples and not for the masses because the masses were unable to turn the other cheek. Gandhi affirmed his belief in the truth that Jesus spoke, noting that he believed in what Jesus lived and was thus a part of him. Gandhi also told Nelson about soul force and that he coined the term while in South Africa. It was a more positive expression of the idea of nonviolence, and in India it proved a more effective instrument against the English colonialists than physical force. He observed that the Indians might have killed their viceroys and others and perhaps driven them out, but that would have prevented a peaceful end to British colonialism. Gandhi, however, drew for Nelson a sharp distinction between passive resistance and nonviolence. The Indians wrongly interpreted his teaching as a method of passive resistance. Instead, Gandhi wanted them to internalize nonviolence as a way of thinking and acting. They had acted nonviolently toward the English, Gandhi declared, but now they, the Hindus and Muslims, are killing each other. He believed India had still failed to achieve real nonviolence. Though Nelson remained hopeful about the use of nonviolent direct action in the United States, Gandhi skeptically said it was a guess. In a second encounter, Nelson asked Gandhi if he would send a brief message of greeting and encouragement to the colored people of America. Gandhi responded that the best message he could convey was the example of his life. Despite the lack of specific suggestions, the Indian leader showed a keen interest in the race problem in America and the hope that his efforts in India might be emulated in the United States. It became Nelson's task to apply what he learned about Quaker pacifism and Gandhian soul force to ending racial oppression in his native land. What affected Nelson even more than Gandhi's vague recommendations for Black liberation was his courage during intense Hindu-Muslim violence. During India's transition to independence in 1947 and the escalation of inter-religious conflict, Gandhi, a Hindu, resided with a Muslim leader in a strife-torn Calcutta. Nelson credited Gandhi with bringing the first peace and intercommunal fellowship which that city had known for months. Before calm had been restored, Gandhi had been taunted and his reception turned ugly. He was greeted by Hindus with the utmost hostility, including the storming of the house he occupied. Nelson lamented that as Gandhi was acknowledged as father of the country and architect of its freedom, he was being subjected to the vituperations of those whom he had freed. Nelson, however, witnessed a miracle. Peace was restored, and joyous fraternization occurred, especially between Hindus and Muslims. Some testified to divine intervention, but others declared it was the presence of Mahatma Gandhi. People thronged daily to his prayer meetings. Moreover, the masses followed wherever he went, and to all alike he gave his blessing and simple, sound advice. This love feast ended, however, and a reversion happened in Calcutta, and where Hindus and Muslims resumed their fighting. There was large casualties, as well as arson and looting. Gandhi declared a fast to last until peace had been restored. His efforts joined with those of Nelson's Quaker Center to restore peace. Nonetheless, during those episodic moments of tranquility, Nelson, still a fan of the Indian leader, contended that his presence and his words produced an effect which is almost incredible and showed the overwhelming possibilities in sheer spiritual power. He was convinced that the Quakers, in meeting the physical needs of Indians through their spiritual, social, and educational activities, were helping in the work of reconciliation and the promotion of international goodwill in India. Moreover, Gandhi's soul force, a praxis and methodology for societal change, combined with the Friends Initiative, had much to offer the Indian subcontinent and perhaps something to advance the black freedom struggle in America. Despite Calcutta's interreligious and interethnic conflict, Nelson believed the new nation benefited from Gandhi's emphasis on the highest spiritual discipline. Notwithstanding the partition of British India into two countries, Nelson was confident that Gandhi's legacy and India's new leadership would guide the infant democracy to a painful but peaceful integration of its diverse populations. Blacks and whites, facing similar challenges in the United States, had much to learn from these experiences. At the same time, African Americans, like Indians, were a struggling subject people fighting against an oppressive system and could find advice and assistance from India's fledgling democracy. These issues were uppermost in Nelson's mind during his conference with Nehru, a follower of Gandhi and India's first prime minister. Nelson reminded Nehru about the Asian Relations Conference and how it spoke to the condition of Asians and the disadvantaged peoples of African heritage everywhere. Moreover, Nelson was pleased that Gandhi embraced the people of Africa and said the conference would also include them. Nelson correctly concluded that Gandhi and Nehru's interest in Africa also extended to African Americans. He emphasized to Nehru that during his extensive travels throughout India, there was profound interest in American race relations. He suggested that Nehru plan for Indian development with an available group of Negro experts and technicians who could be sent to India to help the new democracy. Because Nehru endorsed the idea, Nelson moved quickly to convince members of the Quaker bureaucracy to support it. He added that Negro individuals and especially educational institutions would be pleased to offer any possible assistance. Unexpectedly, President Mordecai W. Johnson hired one of Nelson's Indian proteges as a visiting professor at Howard University. And this protege of Nelson's had been useful and had accompanied him on his visits to Ghana. The American Friends Service Committee committed to international and interracial understanding through its assignment of the Nelsons to India. They were a test case, and from the Friends' perspective, the couple passed with flying colors. This Friends Service Committee was pleased that Nelson had met Gandhi and had gone to areas of special tension, and were pleased with Blanche Nelson's involvement with women's organizations. The couple became what the Quakers desired from Friends ambassadors. As they were departing, the same official who lauded them also asked a colleague for a frank evaluation and whether we should replace them with another Negro couple. Though she conceded that they had made a very real contribution, it seemed that the Nelsons were unique and could not be duplicated. Nelson disagreed and told her that other Negro appointees would be welcome because of the interest among Indians in the problem of race relations in America is deep and widespread. Nelson declared it as an experience from which we will covet for another couple and for the mutual benefit of nation building in India and the African-American freedom struggle. The persistence of doubts by some within the Friends Service Committee bureaucracy about the value of blacks in this Indian mission seems insignificant when the experience of the Nelsons are measured. So they arrived back in the United States in early 1947, and truly in the early fall of 1947. William Stuart Nelson returned to India again in 1950 with the World Student Service Fund, and again in 1958-1959 as a Fulbright Research Scholar in New Delhi. His speeches, Howard Divinity School courses, and his extensive writings established Nelson as an expert on Gandhi and nonviolence. Through the students he taught, the clergy he mentored, and the innumerable audiences he addressed, Nelson contributed crucial perspectives about nonviolence and societal change that helped to influence the legalized segregation and discrimination. Along with Mays, Thurman, and Mordecai Johnson, William and Blanche Nelson created a religious foundation for the civil rights movement and an intellectual framework for this major moral crusade. Each could claim a direct influence upon particular activists. Nelson, before he left for his first visit to India, had steered Kelly Miller Smith to Harvard Divinity School. Smith became a co-founder of the national affiliate of Martin Luther King Jr. Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Nelson told King during the Montgomery bus boycott that your methods have made a deep impression upon me because of my association with Mahatma Gandhi. He added that he asked Gandhi whether his method of nonviolent cooperation might prove successful in the struggle here for our rights. Nelson said it appears to King, appeared to him, that King was experimenting in that direction. King would become an avid Gandhian after hearing a lecture about the Indian leader from Mordecai Johnson, learned about Nelson's India connections, and wanted him to be his guide during his own travels from the Indian to the Asian subcontinent. We met many people in India who knew you, and they never tire of mentioning your name in the most favorable manner, said King to Nelson. He also wanted Nelson to be involved in an SCLC-sponsored nonviolent institute. In eulogizing King after his assassination in 1968, Nelson acknowledged him as a noble disciple of Gandhi. He also credited King in discovering that at the heart of nonviolence is love. Nelson, however, failed to include himself as an important teacher of nonviolence, which he spread to countless campus and church settings where he lectured and preached throughout the 1950s and 1960s. His Indian experiences mattered in large and significant ways. In the civil rights movement, as they invigorated the civic and theological discourse that helped to undermine American apartheid. Just as he had followed his friends and colleagues, Benjamin Mays and Howard Thurman, to India to learn more about Gandhian nonviolence, so he and his wife Blanche traveled to the Indian subcontinent to glean from Quaker and Gandhian praxis ideas and methods to aid the black struggle for freedom. A succeeding generation of activists, James M. Boston and Martin Luther King, also went to India and brought these experiences to the successful effort to bring equality and justice to American society. Reverend Lawson, this is my gift to you.
Saying that I'm not sure exactly how to handle this particular stage of my life and to express my appreciation to the university, to Lloyd McGee, to Nick Zeppos, to Lucius Outlaw. It's rather extraordinary day to have a chair. Does represent a new possibility to help Vanderbilt as it continues to emerge as an outstanding institution in the United States and an outstanding university in our world. We surely have to say to them our great thanks, appreciation, not only for this day, tomorrow, but I have to say especially try leadership the world desperately needs in our town. So thank you, friends, from the very bottom of my heart. Secondly, I want to express my appreciation to Dennis Dickinson. I agree so very much with the selection of Dennis as the first doctor to hire this chair. Dennis does tremendous tools for his teaching work. He brings a heart that is imbued with spirituality that instructs and encourages and embraces and enlarges life. He comes with a kind of mind that, as Nick said so well, prepared to let the past be examined by the present to allow it to find the ways to create a different future. He has a large vision both of the movement of the civil rights movement and also of the labor movement, both movements unrespected, in my judgment, in the United States for what they contributed to create a consciousness this land and an idea of what it means to be a nation and a people. So Dennis, thank you very much for this offering this evening and for the scholarship it represents. And especially for opening up, I'm sure, for a lot of people, the name of William Stuart Nelson, one again of the unknown names, but an honored name among many of us for his life and work. Decades of the 50s and the 60s. Then I want to ask Dennis Dickinson's family to please stand, because they are here in numbers, and I want them to stand so that we can greet them for being here for this wonderful occasion.
Beauty and mystery and wonder that indeed
this university to help lead the way in tapping that kind of vision for the role of the university. And I have to tell you that this last several months have been for me extremely exciting and wonderful. And I wish this university, this leadership, that is to accept the very high calling of the strength of life and the strength of eternity as this process continues. No one can possibly know what history at this moment is calling us to do and be. But one thing I know, at least, is that we are called as human beings to take better care of ourselves.